punish those involved by stripping them naked, placing them in solitary confinement, and forcing them to do push-ups. At the time of the study, Christina Maslach was a psychology postgraduate at Stanford University and involved in a romantic relationship with Zimbardo. Curious to discover how her partner's experiment was progressing, Maslach visited the prison and briefly chatted to one of the off-duty guards. The man came across as friendly and affable. A few moments later, one of the experimenters asked Maslach if she would like to see one of the guards in action. They explained that they had labeled the guard John Wayne because of the aggressive way he handled the prisoners. When Maslach looked, she was stunned to see that John Wayne was actually the friendly guard she had met earlier. When he wasn't in the prison environment, the guard seemed to be pleasant and placid. Inside the mock prison, he appeared to become a completely different person, shouting at the prisoners and treating them poorly. After visiting the mock prison, Maslach had a heated argument with Zimbardo. She thought that the situation had spiraled out of control and should be stopped. Normally gentle and sensitive, Zimbardo appeared distant and inclined to let the project continue. Maslach was stunned. She realized that Zimbardo had adopted his role as the prison supervisor and was no longer standing outside the study, but had instead become an integral part of it. As the argument continued, Zimbardo realized what had happened and decided to call a halt to the study. Although originally planned to run for 2 weeks, the experiment was abruptly terminated after only 6 days. A key part of Zimbardo's experiment involved exploring whether acting as if they were a prisoner or guard would influence participants' identities. The results were as fast as they were dramatic. After the experiment, one of the guards noted, "I really thought that I was incapable of this kind of behavior. I was dismayed that I could have acted in a manner that is so absolutely unaccustomed to anything that I would really dream of doing. And while I was doing it, I didn't feel any regret or any guilt. It was only afterwards, when I began to reflect on what I had done, that it began to dawn on me, and I realized that this was a part of me that I hadn't really noticed before." Similarly, those playing the role of the prisoners also changed their identities, with most of them becoming extremely passive and far more submissive. These rapid changes often had an extremely negative effect on the prisoners. Doug Corpy, prisoner 8612, suffered one of the more extreme emotional reactions and was released during day 2 of the study. Fascinated by his behavior during the study, Corpy went on to study forensic psychology and work in Californian prisons. A few days later, 4 other prisoners were released early due to evidence of anxiety, depression, and anger. Zimbardo's classic study illustrates the power of acting as if. People's sense of unique identity comes from their name, clothing, and appearance. In the prison study, all of these were removed, causing people to lose their own sense of identity and replace it with the role they had been assigned. Dressing and acting as if they were prisoners or guards, the participants had started to think in ways that they considered consistent with their roles. One group quickly became aggressive and authoritarian, the other passive and conforming. Zimbardo conducted his study inside a mock prison and used the as-if principle to create aggression and anxiety. Other research has shown that the same principle operates in everyday life and applies to many aspects of identity. In one study, for instance, researchers tracked the lives of a group of women over the course of several years and discovered that those who were given extra responsibilities in the workplace developed more assertive personalities. In another study, employees who were given more demanding work became more flexible and confident. A large part of people's personalities are not fixed. Instead, they often accept the roles that they have been assigned by themselves and others, behave accordingly, and then develop an identity that matches this role. Perhaps most intriguing of all, other psychologists have explored how people can use this effect to transform their lives for the better. Lights, camera, action. George Kelly was born in 1905 on a Kansas farm. After high school, he received a degree in physics, moved to Minnesota, and taught public speaking. Then he stopped teaching public speaking, enrolled at the State University of Iowa, and was eventually awarded a doctorate in psychology. Recognizing the difficulties of farming families during the Depression, Kelly decided to take his psychology on the road and act as a traveling psychotherapist. At first, he adopted a Freudian approach, asking farmers to lie down on his couch and describe their dreams. However, he soon found Freudian theory too esoteric for the down-to-earth farmers, and so started to develop more practical ways of tackling their problems. One of Kelly's first creations has come to be known as Mirror Time. During these sessions, people would be encouraged to spend 30 minutes sitting in front of a mirror, looking at their reflection and thinking about what they saw. Did they like or dislike the person in front of them? What were the differences between the person in the mirror and the person they wanted to be? What did they see in their face that others missed? Although people often enjoyed staring longingly into their own eyes, Kelly wasn't convinced that these moments of deep reflection were proving especially helpful, and so he decided to draw on his experience of teaching public speaking to encourage people to explore other ways of seeing the world. His extensive therapeutic experience led him to believe that people's personalities were not fixed, and in the same way that actors play many different roles during their career, so people can change their identities throughout their lifetime. Moreover, Kelly was convinced that the way in which people saw themselves was often at the root of their problems, and that effective therapy involved helping clients adopt a less problematic identity. Kelly christened this approach fixed role therapy, and over time developed a series of effective techniques for getting people to adopt a new identity. The first stage of fixed role therapy usually involves various exercises that are designed to help you understand how you currently see yourself. One of the most popular exercises involves comparing yourself to several other individuals you know in order to identify the core psychological dimensions that you use to classify people. Another exercise might be writing a short description of yourself from someone else's perspective. On the basis of the results, you design a new identity for yourself. This new identity might entail a radical overhaul of your personality, or just tweaking a few small aspects. You then spend some time thinking about how this new you would behave in the types of situation you encounter every day, and possibly involve some role-playing to help solidify these new behavioral patterns. In the next part of the process, you play your new role for about 2 weeks. Kelly's research then revealed something strange. After spending a few weeks behaving in a completely different way, many people started to forget that they were playing a role and began to develop a new identity. Many of Kelly's clients reported that the new role seemed as though it had always been their real self, and that it was only now that they were becoming fully aware of it. People had created a new sense of identity by behaving like the person that they wanted to be, exactly as predicted by the as-if principle. The same principle can also help bring people together by getting them to see how the world looks to others. In one study, for example, one group of students was asked to behave as if they had recently been paralyzed in a road accident and were now confined to a wheelchair. The students spent 25 minutes working their way around a pre-specified route in a wheelchair, and so had to navigate several lifts, ramps, and doors. Another group of students walked behind the wheelchairs and witnessed everything that happened. Both groups were then asked about their attitudes about issues related to disability, including, for example, whether public funds should be spent on a new rehabilitation center. A remarkable difference emerged between the groups, with those who had spent time in a wheelchair showing far greater empathy for the disabled. The same principle is often used in a form of therapy known as psychodrama. By getting clients to adopt different personas, and sometimes even role-play friends and colleagues, they see their life from several very different perspectives. Kelly's research has provided new and improved identities for tens of thousands of people across the world. New technology has taken the idea to previously unimaginable heights. Who do you think you are? Part 1. Do you want to find out how you see yourself and others? The following two exercises, based on the work of George Kelly, will give you an insight into how you perceive your personality. Footnote. The exercises described here are designed to provide a general insight into the sorts of techniques that are used by psychologists. If you believe that you have a serious problem in your life, consult a professional. End footnote. Exercise 1. Your constructs. This four-stage exercise usually takes about 20 minutes to complete and is designed to give you insight into the core dimensions that you use to see yourself and others. Write all of your answers on a piece of paper. Stage 1. Think of 5 people you know well. Perhaps your mother, your father, your closest friend, your boss, your partner, a work colleague, or a past lover. Write the names of these people on your piece of paper. Stage 2. Now consider the following table. Think of one way in which the personalities of Person 1 and Person 2 differ from you. Perhaps, for example, Person 1 and Person 2 are outgoing and you are shy. Or perhaps they are both somewhat stingy and you more giving. Copy the table onto your paper and write down the way in which Person 1 and Person 2 are similar in the column marked Way in which they are similar, and the opposite trait, which should describe your personality, in the column marked Me. Stage 3. Move into the next row and repeat the same process. Once again, think about how Person 2 and Person 3 are similar and how they differ from you. Carry on like this down the table, trying to come up with different traits each time. Stage 4. Consider the resulting list of traits in the Me column and try to identify some commonalities. Do words like anxious and relaxed appear a lot? Or perhaps the words outgoing and shy make regular appearances? These are the core psychological constructs that you use to see yourself and others. Exercise 2. The description. Part 1. Spend about 20 minutes writing a brief description of yourself. Write this description from the third-person perspective, perhaps as you think a close friend or work colleague sees you. Part 2. The following stages are designed to help you create and adopt new aspects of your identity. Stage 1. Take a look at the constructs that you use to describe yourself in Exercise 1. Do you think that any one of these constructs are negative or problematic? Now look at the description that you produced in Exercise 2. Does that contain any clues about which aspects of your identity you would like to change? Perhaps, for example, you don't think that you are very confident, are struggling to make friends, are overly aggressive, or seem a bit selfish. Stage 2. Use this information as a basis for the new you. If you're struggling to think about how you want to change, perhaps draw on elements that you admire in friends, colleagues, role models, and even fictional characters in books, movies, and plays. Alternatively, consider the following list of character strengths and their descriptions, and choose one or more that appear especially appealing. Creativity. Good at thinking of novel ways to do things. Curiosity. Having an interest in exploring and discovering. Open-mindedness. Being willing to examine issues from several perspectives. Bravery. Not running away from a threat or challenge. Persistence. Keeping with it when the going gets tough. Vitality. Approaching life with zest and energy. Love. Being able to form close relationships with others. Kindness. Enjoying giving to other people. Citizenship. Being a team player and supporting those around you. Leadership. Taking responsibility and moving forward. Forgiveness. Being able to forgive those who have done wrong. Humility. Not drawing attention to your achievements. Prudence. Expressing self-control and not being overly impulsive. Gratitude. Being thankful for the good things in your life. Hope. Expecting that good things will happen and being prepared to work to achieve them. humour, seeing the funny side of life and being light-hearted. Next, write a short description of the new you, focusing on how you will behave differently in everyday situations. For example, let's imagine that you tend to be overly aggressive and frequently get into arguments with your friends and colleagues. The new you might be a lot more relaxed and fun to be with. If that were the case, how would you behave? Would you joke around? Would you ask other people for their thoughts and opinions and accept these comments rather than use them as the basis for an argument? Would you make a special effort to give praise and encouragement? Alternatively, let's imagine that a few people have remarked on the fact that you are stingy and you have decided to change this part of your character. Would the new you contribute to charity, give generous gifts to others, and go out of your way to help those around you? Or maybe you would like to be more confident. If so, do you have an especially assertive friend or colleague who could act as an inspiration for the new you? How does that person behave in the types of situations that you struggle with? Can you pretend to be that person and act differently from the old you in these situations? Stage 3. Spend around 2 weeks role-playing your new identity. Focus on changing your behavior rather than trying to change the way you think. To help with this process, you might also ask a close friend or family member to role-play a few common situations with the new you. Also, rather than seeing yourself as undergoing a permanent change, it might be helpful to think of your old personality as being on vacation for 2 weeks, and so you have an opportunity to act like a different person. It is important, however, that you play out your new role 24 hours a day, even when you're alone. The as-if principle will cause you to feel like a new person, and the new you will soon become part of your actual identity. Orcs and Elves. Jeremy Baylinson runs the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University. Much of his work is creating computer-generated representations of humans, referred to as avatars, and having them move around virtual worlds. Baylinson came across the as-if principle and wondered whether it would also operate in the imaginary worlds that he created. Would, for instance, people who were given a tall avatar in a computer game feel more assertive in real life? Or would those who were given an avatar dressed in black become more aggressive? The possibilities seemed endless. But first, Baylinson had to discover whether the principle operated in the virtual world. To find out, he turned to the international phenomenon that is World of Warcraft. World of Warcraft is a hugely popular online fantasy game in which millions of people across the globe fight against one another in a virtual land. The game involves taking part in epic sieges and a host of legendary experiences, with each player trying to get through 60 levels of increasing difficulty. Before starting the game, players have to create their own avatar. These virtual identities are based on one of 8 different races, including gnomes, night elves, orcs, trolls, and humans, with each race having a predetermined height. For example, gnomes are somewhat short, while trolls are much taller. Baylinson and his colleague Nick Yee knew that in real life, taller people are more assertive than shorter people, and wondered whether the same effect would emerge among the World of Warcraft avatars. To find out, they examined the data from more than 26,000 players, looking at the relationship between the height of each player's avatar and how far the player had progressed in the game. The virtual world mimicked the real world, with players having relatively tall avatars, think trolls and orcs, outperforming those with shorter virtual selves, think dwarfs or gnomes. These results have 2 important implications. They suggest that the as-if principle functions in virtual worlds, and on a more practical level, if you want to gain the edge in World of Warcraft, become a troll rather than a gnome. Although Baylinson and Yee were excited by their results, they realized that there were 2 problems. First, critics might argue that more competent or assertive players had simply chosen taller avatars at the start of the game. Also, even if the height of a person's avatar did change the way this player behaved online, There was no guarantee that it would affect him in the real world. Bailenson and Yi tackled both issues in a second experiment. In this study, a group of students were asked to wear virtual reality glasses that allowed them to see a virtual version of themselves on a computer screen. To make the situation as realistic as possible, the research team attached high-tech sensors to the students' faces, arms, and legs, and ensured that the virtual figure copied their movements. If the student looked to the left, so did the avatar. If the person started to jog, the avatar trotted along too. The close match-up between the participants' actual movements and those of their virtual self resulted in the students quickly believing they were the figure on the screen. At the start of the experiment, the researchers randomly assigned a tall or short avatar to each participant. Then, after the students had spent some time in the virtual world, they were asked to remove their headsets, come back to the real world, meet another participant, and play a game called Ultimatum. In this game, one player has just one shot at proposing a way of dividing $100 between both players. If the second player accepts the offer, the cash is divided. If, however, the second player rejects the offer, then neither player gets anything. The test has been used in psychology departments across the world for years, with the first player's opening offer being seen as a good reflection of how assertive and aggressive this person is. The players who had been given a tall avatar made more assertive opening offers than those who had been assigned a short avatar, as predicted by the as-if principle. The difference was far from trivial, with those with taller virtual selves offering, on average, a 60-40 split, while those with shorter avatars offered a 50-50 split. Not only that, but those with taller avatars were also more assertive when it came to accepting or rejecting the offers of others. Around 60% of those with tall virtual selves rejected a 75-25 split in favor of the other player, compared with just 30% of those with short avatars. Bailenson and Yi's work paved the way for an explosion of similar studies. In one study, some volunteers saw their avatars run on treadmills, while another group saw their virtual selves lounging around. When the researchers tracked the participants over time, they discovered that those who had seen themselves running around in the virtual world were far more likely to exercise for real. In another experiment, people who inhabited a physically older avatar were subsequently more likely to agree to contribute more to their pensions. Time and again, the research has shown that the as-if principle does indeed operate in the virtual world, and that seeing an avatar look and behave in a certain way affects how people think and behave in the real world. Bailenson has labelled the phenomenon the Proteus effect, after the Greek god who can change his shape and identity at will. The effect opens up the as-if principle to new worlds, limited only by our imaginations. 5. Turning back time. Born in the Bronx, psychologist Ellen Langer began her college career studying chemistry at New York University. Realizing that a life among the test tubes wasn't for her, she later noted, "I practiced Jewish chemistry. A little is good. More is better." She enrolled in an introductory psychology course being taught by Philip Zimbardo and was hooked. Langer eventually became a professor at Harvard University, with much of her work attempting to unravel the mysteries of aging. She has conducted many high-profile studies during her career. In one classic experiment, some of the residents in a nursing home were given a houseplant to look after, while the others were given an identical plant, but told that the staff would take responsibility for it. 6 months later, the residents who'd been robbed of even this small amount of control over their lives were significantly less happy, healthy, and active than the others. Even more distressing, 30% of the residents who had not looked after their plant had died, compared with just 15% of those who had been allowed to exercise control. In a similar study, she examined the effect of encouraging elderly people to behave as if they are still mentally active. In this experiment, the researchers visited one group of residents each week and asked them various questions, such as the names of the nurses and the nature of the activities that would be taking place in the nursing home on particular days. If the residents were uncertain about the answers, the experimenters encouraged them to find out by the next visit. The effects were dramatic. Compared with a control group of residents who were not presented with such challenges, those asked to remember simple questions developed superior short-term memories and appeared far more alert. The researchers revisited the homes 2.5 years later and found that only 7% of the group had passed away, compared with nearly 30% of the control group. Perhaps Langer's most striking study involves getting people to use the as-if principle to travel back in time. In 1979, she recruited a group of men in their 70s and 80s for what was described as a week of reminiscence at a retreat outside Boston. Before the study started, Langer asked all the men to take part in a series of tests measuring their physical strength, posture, eyesight, and memory. She then randomly split the men into two groups and told one group, the time travelers, that the experiment was about the psychological impact of actually reliving the past, and the other group that it was all about the effects of reminiscing. Langer had decided to try to turn back the hands of time by 20 years, and so encouraged the participants to either relive or reminisce about their lives in 1959. Next, she arranged to bus the group that would be reliving the past to a 10-acre country retreat. To get them in the mood for the study, Langer played 1959 radio broadcasts throughout the trip. She was interested in encouraging the participants to act as if they were 20 years younger throughout the experiment. When the time travelers arrived at the retreat, for instance, there was no one there to help them off the bus, and they had to carry their suitcases inside. In addition, the retreat had not been equipped with the types of rails and other movement aids they had at the nursing home. Participants had been asked to supply photographs of themselves from 1959, and when they went to their bedrooms, each participant found copies of all those photographs, along with 1959 issues of Life magazine and the Saturday Evening Post. After unpacking, everyone was assembled in the main room of the retreat. Surrounded by various objects from the era, including a black-and-white television and a vintage radio, Langer informed the participants that for the next few days, all of their conversations about the past had to be in the present tense, and that no conversation must mention anything that happened after 1959. Each day, the participants took part in various carefully orchestrated activities and discussions. During one activity, for example, they were asked to write an autobiographical sketch in the present tense, ending in 1959. Other times, they were taken to a makeshift movie theater to watch Anatomy of a Murder, starring James Stewart, took part in discussions about the launch of the first American satellite, played games such as The Price is Right using old prices, heard a speech by President Eisenhower, and sat around the radio listening as the horse Royal Orbit won the 1959 Preakness Stakes. For the control group, life was very different. They heard present-day music on the bus, were asked to reminisce about 1959 in the past tense, were given current photographs of one another, and watched recent movies. Within days, Langer could see the dramatic effect of behaving as if. The time-traveling participants were now walking faster and were more confident. Moreover, within a week, several of these participants had decided that they could now manage without their canes. Langer took various psychological and physiological measurements throughout the experiment and discovered that the time-traveling group showed improvements in dexterity, speed of movement, memory, blood pressure, eyesight, and hearing. Interestingly, more than 60% of those in the time-traveling group showed an improvement on intelligence tests, compared with just 40% of those in the other group. Acting as if they were young men had knocked years off their bodies and minds. To discover if Langer's original work could be repeated, the BBC recently reran her experiment. Six elderly British celebrities agreed to try to turn back the clock to their heyday during the 1970s. The BBC uncovered photographs of the celebrities' bedrooms during the 1970s and reconstructed the rooms in minute detail, complete with psychedelic wallpaper and swirling carpets. During the week, each celebrity was given the opportunity to relive an important moment in his or her life, with, for example, dancer Lionel Blair returning to the stage of the Palladium to choreograph a routine. Within just a day or two, many of the celebrities showed an improvement in their memories, physical strength, energy, and mood. The 88-year-old actress Liz Smith had had three immobilizing strokes, but soon showed that she was able to get around without her cane. Prior to the experiment, cricket umpire Dickie Bird had become solitary, but within days he was the life and soul of the party. Tests assessing the participants' biological age suggested that two of the group had the brain of a person 20 years their junior, and overall the group showed significant improvements in memory and intelligence. This is not the only set of experiments to show that it is possible to slow down the effects of aging by acting like a younger person. In another experiment, Langer asked people to role-play Air Force pilots and examined the impact on their vision. 19 Air Force cadets had their eyesight tested and were then split randomly into two groups. An instructor invited each of the cadets in one of the groups to go into a flight simulator and attempt to fly a plane. Those in the other group were also asked to climb into the pilot seat, but were told the simulator was broken. All of the participants were then asked to read the letters on the sides of airplanes they saw through the cockpit window. Those acting as if they were fighter pilots improved their vision by 40%, while those who weren't behaving in this way showed no change at all. Other work examined whether being around children really does keep you young. In one study, Langer examined the life expectancies of women who had children later in life compared with those who had them in their younger years. You might think that running around very young children when you are in your 40s is not such a great idea. You would be wrong. In fact, the women who had children later in life had significantly longer life expectancies than others. In a similar vein, Langer looked through the marriage registers searching for couples who differed in age by more than 4 years. Langer hypothesized that the younger partners will be likely to behave as if they are older than they actually are, and the older partners as if they are younger. This had a significant effect on their life expectancy, with the younger ones having significantly shorter lifespans. Then, not for the first time in this book, there is the power of dance. Researchers at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City followed a group of more than 500 participants between 1980 and 2001. When they joined the study, everyone was to indicate the degree to which they carried out various activities that stimulated their brains: reading, writing for pleasure, solving crosswords, playing board games, taking part in discussions, and playing a musical instrument. Or bodies: playing tennis or golf, swimming, bicycling, dancing, walking, climbing, doing housework. When 500 of the participants were more than 75 years old, the researchers monitored the degree to which they had developed dementia. Those who were readers showed a 35% reduced risk of dementia, while doing crossword puzzles at least 4 times a week showed a 47% drop. Interestingly, almost none of the physical activities, such as bicycling and swimming, had any impact at all. The exception to the rule was dancing, with the regular dancers in the group exhibiting a massive 76% drop. By consistently dancing the night away, these people were acting as if they were young, and this helped slow the effects of aging over time. As the playwright George Bernard Shaw once wisely remarked, "We don't stop playing because we grow old. We grow old because we stop playing." How to slow aging. Here are 5 tips based on the research of Ellen Langer to help slow the effects of aging. Maintain a sense of control in your life. Do not associate old age with helplessness and reliance on others. Instead, try to exert control over as many aspects of your life as possible. Langer's work suggests that even the smallest amounts of control make a big difference. Shop for yourself. Look after a houseplant. Tend to your garden. Get a pet. Take charge of your finances. and get out and about under your own steam. Keep mentally active. There is a great deal of debate about whether so-called brain training affects your mental well-being. However, acting as if you are interested in the world around you is beneficial. Keep up with world news. Find out what is happening in your area. Start a blog. Set goals. Remain curious. Maintain hobbies and interests. And stay in touch with friends and family. Stay young at heart. Langer's work shows that those who spend time with children and younger people stay young. Make room in your life for grandchildren and young friends and neighbors. Be actively active. Try to move like a younger person. Keep as physically active as you can. Continue to be involved in sports. Put a spring in your step. And remember that by far the most psychological benefit is derived from dancing. Make an effort. The way that you look influences how you feel. In one study, Langer measured the blood pressure of women before and after they had their hair colored. Women who thought that they looked younger after the appointment showed a significant reduction in blood pressure. Make an effort to look and dress a few years younger than you actually are. Conclusion. Where we hypnotize a woman, saw a brain in half, and discover why you really are of two minds about everything. Everything we have seen indicates that the surgery has left these people with two separate minds. That is, two separate spheres of consciousness. Roger Sperry, neuroscientist. Our journey has revealed the remarkable truth about your body and brain. For thousands of years, people have assumed that the relationship between their brain and body is much like that of a rider to a horse. In the same way that a rider determines how a horse behaves, so our minds decide what our bodies do. Because of this, those wishing to change their lives have spent vast amounts of time and money trying to alter how they think. Encouraged by self-appointed gurus and life coaches, these people have attempted to visualize their perfect self, think like a millionaire, and adopt a positive mindset. Unfortunately, this approach to change is difficult, time-consuming, and frequently ineffective. More than a century ago, Harvard philosopher William James turned the conventional view of the human psyche on its head. He suggested that our actions influence how we think and feel, and argued that it should be possible to easily alter our thoughts and emotions by changing our behavior. 80 years after James proposed his odd-sounding theory, a small number of maverick researchers carried out the first experiments to discover whether he was right. Their positive findings inspired other scientists to conduct similar research, and over time, this work has revealed that the as-if principle can help explain people's emotions, levels of motivation, beliefs, and personalities. The message from this remarkable body of research is clear. It is not just that the mind influences the body, but rather that the body also influences the mind. This simple idea has given rise to a series of quick, easy, and effective techniques that can help people become happier, avoid anxiety and depression, fall in love and live happily ever after, beat procrastination, and even slow the effects of aging. None of these techniques is about trying to change the way you think. Instead, they all entail ripping up the rules about self-development, changing the way you behave, and are based on William James's century-old maxim, if you want a quality, act as if you already have it. This work has important consequences for anyone wishing to understand the mysteries of the mind. Since its inception around the turn of the last century, psychology has struggled to find a single concept that can be applied to the many different facets of the human psyche, including emotion, thought, and behavior. For example, research into the psychology of motivation has produced several theories that help explain what makes people get up and go. But these ideas do little to further our understanding of happiness. Similarly, other work has tackled what happens when people feel sad, but these theories have nothing to say to those interested in understanding the psychology of persuasion. The as-if principle does not suffer from such limitations. from passion to phobias, confidence to creativity, and persistence to personality, the same simple notion provides a remarkable insight into a diverse range of phenomena, and in doing so, offers the very real possibility of being psychology's first unifying theory. Although such theoretical considerations are fascinating, the as-if principle also has important practical consequences. As we have seen throughout this book, this deceptively simple idea provides the basis for a diverse range of self-development techniques that are quick, easy, and highly effective. Clench your muscles and you develop instant willpower. Force your face into a smile and you feel happier. Stand up straight and you become far more confident. The same principle has also inspired other exercises that pave the way for longer-lasting and large-scale change, including those that help people shape their personality, lose weight, and alter the beliefs of entire nations. New experiments into the as-if principle are now being regularly reported at scientific conferences and published in academic journals. Just over 100 years after James came up with his controversial theory, the principle has come in from the cold and is accepted as part of mainstream psychology. Indeed, some researchers are convinced that the as-if principle is not just a fascinating quirk of the human mind, but is actually operating every moment of every human being's waking life. To support their case, they point to a strange body of work involving post-hypnotic suggestion, brain surgery, and a picture of a chicken's claw. Dr. Zomb and the People with Two Brains. When I was a child, I developed a strong interest in conjuring and have worked as a professional magician. When I was in my early 20s, I thought that it might be fun to learn how to become a hypnotist, and so I visited my local magic shop and bought a book entitled The New Encyclopedia of Stage Hypnotism by Ormond McGill. McGill was an experienced hypnotist who had worked under the stage name Dr. Zomb, and his book claimed to present a step-by-step guide to placing people in a deep trance. Inspired by Zomb's authoritative tone, I read his encyclopedia from cover to cover, learned the various induction procedures, and decided to give it a try. Rather than risk making a fool of myself on stage, I thought it best to try out my newly found skills on Claire. Claire and I had been sharing a house for about a year, and so she was used to being asked to choose cards and think of the first number that came into her head. I asked Claire whether she would like to be my very first hypnotism guinea pig, and she kindly agreed. About 10 minutes later, Claire was lying on our comfy sofa, and I was sitting in a nearby chair. I recited one of Dr. Zomb's most powerful induction procedures, asking Claire to close her eyes and drift away from consciousness. After a few minutes, Claire was lying motionless on the sofa. Everything seemed to be going well, so I asked Claire to imagine that the number 6 didn't exist, and then to count from 1 to 10. A few moments later, Claire started her count, and I was thrilled to hear her confidently come out with the numbers 4, 5, 7, 8. After working my way through several other standard hypnotic exercises, I decided to add one of Dr. Zomb's post-session suggestions. I told Claire that when she awoke, she wouldn't remember anything about the sessions, but would feel a strange urge to wander across the room and open a window. A few moments later, I counted to 10 and Claire suddenly opened her eyes. Slightly dazed, she asked how the session had gone. I said that all was well and explained about the mystery of the missing 6 and the other exercises. At the end of the discussion, Claire stood up, walked across the room, and opened the window. Bemused, I casually asked her why she had opened the window on what was quite a chilly day. Claire confidently explained that she felt hot and so needed some fresh air. Many proponents of hypnosis would argue that it is as if there are two people inside Claire's head. One of them controlled her behavior. Let's call him or her the boss. And the other observes these actions and tries to work out what is going on, the observer. According to this theory, in everyday life, the boss is actually the one in charge, but people are only aware of the observer. So, for example, the boss might head to a restaurant and the observer would look at what was going on and conclude that he or she must be hungry. Or the boss might look longingly at his or her spouse, and the observer might conclude that they are in love. However, when people are hypnotized, the observer takes some much-needed time off, and it is possible to talk directly to the boss. When I hypnotized Claire, I told the boss to open the window when the session had ended. When Claire came out of the trance, the observer woke back up and all seemed well. Then, as instructed, the boss opened the window, and the observer saw what was going on and assumed that Claire must feel hot. Psychologists have long debated the nature of hypnosis. Some have argued that people can indeed enter a strange trance-like state, and that during a hypnotic session, it is possible to talk to other aspects of a person's psyche. In contrast, others have argued that hypnosis is just an elaborate form of role play. It is a long and complex debate, and so my experience with Claire does not constitute strong proof for the existence of the boss and the observer. Fortunately, this is far from the only evidence that we all have two people inside our head. During some brain operations, patients can be fully conscious and able to report their thoughts and feelings. In the late 1960s, brain surgeon José Delgado thought that it would be interesting to see how his patients felt when he stimulated different parts of their brain during an operation. In several operations, Delgado applied a tiny electrical pulse to the part of the brain that controlled head turning. On cue, each of the patients slowly rotated his or her head to the right and then the left. However, when Delgado asked the patients why they were behaving in this way, most of them quickly justified their actions, explaining, for example, that they were looking for their slippers, had heard a noise, or just generally felt restless. Once again, it seemed that the patients had looked at their actions and created a plausible narrative to explain what was going on. By far the most profound work into this notion was carried out in the early 1970s by an American neuropsychologist, Roger Sperry. Sperry and his colleagues originally set out to devise a new treatment for epilepsy. They knew that the brain consists of two large hemispheres connected by a thick band of nerve fibers called the corpus callosum, and that previous work had revealed that some epileptic episodes were the result of excessive electrical activity in one of these two hemispheres quickly spreading to the other. Sperry wondered if it might be possible to prevent this electrical storm by cutting the tissue that connected the two hemispheres. To find out, he operated on several patients with epilepsy, severing the entirety of their corpus callosum. This dramatic procedure proved a considerable success, with the majority of the patients going on to lead normal lives. However, it was Sperry's additional experiments with these so-called split-brain patients that yielded a remarkable insight into who we are. Each of the hemispheres controls muscles on the opposite side of the body. The right hemisphere controls muscles on the left side of your body, for instance, and the left hemisphere controls muscles on your right side. The same process also applies to the images entering your eyes, with images from the left-hand side of your visual field going to the right hemisphere, and images from the right going to the left. Normally, the corpus callosum ensures that this information quickly flows between the hemispheres, and so is available to both sides of the brain. Sperry realized that this sharing of information couldn't happen in his split-brain patients, and thus that it should be possible to work with them to investigate the different abilities of the hemispheres. The research team constructed a laboratory inside a camper trailer, hitched the trailer up to a van, and toured around the country, testing participants. In one series of studies, each participant was asked to focus on a dot in the center of a screen. Sperry then flashed up images on either the right or left of the dot. These flashes were deliberately so fast that the patients did not have time to move their eyes, which in turn ensured that the image went to just the right or left hemisphere. Language and self-awareness tend to be located in the left hemisphere. So when Sperry flashed up a picture of an object on the right of the screen, the patient could easily name the object. However, when the same picture was flashed on the left-hand side of the screen, it was fed to the right hemisphere, and the patient felt as if he or she had seen nothing. Nevertheless, the images influenced the patient's behavior. When, for example, the word smile was flashed up on the left of the screen, the patient would smile. When an image of a nude woman was flashed up to male patients, an appreciative grin would sometimes spread across their faces. These patients had no insight into the real cause of their behavior. And so, when asked to explain their actions, they would say that they were smiling because they found the experiment funny, or said they looked appreciative because they found the experimenter attractive. Once again, it was as if the observer was watching their actions and trying to explain what was going on. In another study, the researchers showed the split-brain patients two pictures, presenting one picture to each hemisphere. The participants were then asked to look at an assortment of other pictures and choose an image that was most closely related to the original pictures. For example, in one instance, a patient had a picture of a chicken claw flashed to the left hemisphere and a snow scene to the right hemisphere. When shown the ensuing selection of other images, the patient correctly selected a shovel with his left hand and a chicken with his right hand. When the researchers asked the patient to account for his actions, the patient explained that the chicken claw was obviously associated with a chicken and that you needed a shovel to clean out a chicken shed. Once again, it was as if the observer saw how the patient behaved, had no insight into why this was the case, and made up a story to account for his actions. Sperry's work strongly suggests that one part of your brain decides whether to eat, sleep, laugh, or cry, and another observes your actions and then tells you a story in an attempt to explain what is going on. Seen in this way, the as-if principle is not simply a fascinating quirk of the human mind, but instead underlies every thought and feeling that you have experienced throughout your entire life. Over a century ago, William James proposed that behavior causes emotion. It was a simple idea that changed everything. 100 years of research has revealed that James's theory applies to a remarkable range of psychological phenomena, from persuasion to procrastination, fear to phobias, and passion to personality. In addition, it provides a profound insight into the fundamental nature of the human mind, and has the power to change lives and shape societies. The time has come to jettison out-of-date ideas about the human psyche and adopt William James's radical theory. To use the power of the as-if principle to help people improve their lives and to change the world. Appendix. 10 ways in which your body instantly changes your brain. The preceding chapters contain a series of quick and effective exercises that will help change the way you think and behave. Here is a one-stop description of 10 of the most effective techniques set out in this audiobook. Motivation. Pull me, push you. Pushing an object away from you, and so behaving as if you don't like it, makes you dislike the object, whereas pulling it toward you, behaving as if you like it, makes you feel far more positive about it. Next time that you are confronted with some sugary snacks or chocolate cookies, simply push the plate away from you and feel the temptation fade. Dieting. Using your non-dominant hand. When you eat with your non-dominant hand, you are acting as if you are carrying out an unusual behavior. Because of that, you place more attention on your action. Do not simply consume food without thinking about it, and so eat less. Willpower. Tensing up. Tensing your muscles boosts your willpower. Next time you feel the need to avoid a cigarette or piece of cake, make a fist, contract your bicep, press your thumb and first finger together, or grip a pen in your hand. Persistence. Sit up straight and cross your arms. In several experiments, researchers have presented volunteers with tricky problems and measured how long they persevered. Those who sit up straight and fold their arms persist for nearly twice as long as others. Make sure your computer monitor is slightly above your eyeline, and when the going gets tough, cross your arms. Confidence. Power posing. To increase your self-esteem and confidence, adopt a power pose. If you're sitting down, lean back, look up, and interlock your hands behind your head. If you're standing up, place your feet flat on the floor, push your shoulders back and your chest forward, and hold your hands in front of you. Procrastination. Make a start. To overcome procrastination, act as if you are interested in what it is that you have to do. Spend just a few minutes carrying out the first part of whatever it is you are avoiding, and suddenly you will feel a strong need to complete the task. Creativity. Move outside the box. If you want to come up with new ideas, act in a novel way. Spend some time walking around, but ensure that your path is curvy and unpredictable. If that doesn't get your creative juices flowing, try acting as if you are artistic by drawing, painting, or sculpting. Persuasion. Getting the nod. Researchers have found that when people nod their heads up and down while they listen to a discussion, causing them to nod as if they agreed with the arguments, they are more likely to agree with the points being made. When you want to encourage others to agree with you, subtly nod your head as you chat with them. They will reciprocate the movement and find themselves strangely attracted to your way of thinking. Negotiation. Warm tea and soft chairs. When people think that they are connected to others, they feel physically warm. And it is also true that when you warm someone up with a nice mug of tea or coffee, they become far friendlier. Similarly, hard furniture is associated with hard behavior. In one study, researchers had participants sit on either soft or hard chairs and then negotiate over the price of a used car. Those in the hard chairs offered less and were more inflexible. Guilt. Wash away your sins. If you are feeling a tad guilty about something, try washing your hands or taking a shower. In several experiments, people who carried out an immoral act and then cleaned their hands with an antiseptic wipe felt significantly less guilty than others. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The As-If Principle, The Radically New Approach to Changing Your Life by Richard Wiseman. Copyright 2012 by Richard Wiseman. Performed by Ralph Lister. Directed by Michael Naramore. Performance copyright 2012 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. Recorded by arrangement with Free Press, a division of Simon & Schuster, Inc. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, PO Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.